want our children to have the best chance to live fulfilling lives. But can you keep up with all the books and scientific research on parenting and fit the information into your own philosophy on how to raise kids? Welcome to Your Parenting Mojo, the podcast that does the work for you by investigating and examining respectful, research-based parenting tools to help kids thrive. Now, welcome your host, Jen Lumenlon.
Welcome to the Your Parenting Mojo podcast. Before we get going today, I'd like to take a minute to ask you for a favor. I've been doing some reading about goal setting lately, and I've read that if you set a goal, you should both tell other people about it and also ask for help in achieving it. So I'd like to do that today. I've set a goal for myself to double the number of subscribers I have to this podcast. Now, subscribing doesn't cost you anything at all. It just means that new episodes show up in your podcast feed when they're released on a weekly basis, so you don't have to remember to go and look at them. Weekly podcasts on science-based parenting advice delivered straight to your feed? What could be better? The trick here is that if you subscribe through iTunes, I'm afraid I can't count that as meeting my goal because iTunes actually never tells podcasters that a person has subscribed or how many subscribers I might have in iTunes at any given time. Let's just say it's yet another way that iTunes doesn't help podcasters out. So to count towards my goal, new subscribers need to go to my website at yourparentingmojo.com, enter your email address in the box at the top, and hit subscribe. And you actually get a gift for doing it that way as well, which is a package of 7 relationship-based strategies to help support your child's development, and maybe also make life a bit easier for you. So if you haven't yet subscribed to the show on my website, I'd be really grateful if you wouldn't mind doing that. And if you have already subscribed there, then would you consider telling a friend, or perhaps many friends, about the show? Thanks so much, and I'll let you know when I reach my goal. Now on to today's episode, which is about a book I read way before I started the podcast called All Joy and No Fun by Jennifer Senior. I actually got a question from a listener recently asking me whether there's any research on whether and how her divorce might have impacted her son's development. It turns out that there is, and quite a lot, so I decided to make a series of it with one episode on how divorce impacts children and a second on how single parenting and step families does. And we'll open up that whole lot with this one on All Joy and No Fun, which is basically about the idea that if you ask a parent what is their greatest joy, they'll invariably say, my kids. But if you ask them moment by moment if they're having fun with their children, then unfortunately the answer is pretty often no. Since I first read the book several months ago, I've had a chance to think about it quite a bit. So I'll start as usual with the research, and we'll end with some thoughts on how we can change this idea to some joy and some fun too. And because I think I'm an especially interesting case study for this phenomenon, I'm going to illustrate today's episode with some personal experience. Because why not? So before we get going, I should pause and say that if you're not a family that looks like a mother and father with children, then I'm sorry, but there's actually not a ton of research on your kinds of families, which really does kind of suck. I imagine it's possible that one of you might work longer hours than the other and take on the more father-ish role, and the other works shorter hours or no hours and spends more time with the kids, and that looks more like a mother-ish role. And if so, there will still be plenty here for you. And even if not, and if you really do split everything evenly, then you should send me an email and you can be a guest on the show. If you've ever found yourself wishing that there was as much fun as joy in your life, then there will be something here for you to learn. So a sociologist named Alice Rossi was one of the first people to study the effect of parenting on the parents rather than just on the child. She describes 4 factors that inhibit our abilities as parents. Firstly, that preparation for the role of parent is virtually non-existent, in large part because our educational system provides for children's cognitive development, but not for emotional development or the subjects most relevant to successful family life, which Rossi says are sex, home maintenance, childcare, interpersonal competence, and empathy. I'd say this was doubly so for me because I never really liked children that much. So while I had few opportunities to engage with children as a teen and young adult, I actually went out of my way to avoid those opportunities I did get, simply because I wasn't interested. And anyway, babies cried whenever I held them. Now the second of Rossi's factors is that there is limited learning available during pregnancy. I was among the lucky ones here in the US to have had health insurance that provided a couple of prenatal classes. So I actually had changed a diaper on a doll before my daughter's birth, even if not on a real baby. And I spent so much time reading about pregnancy and labor and delivery, and I was determined to have a natural birth for 2 reasons. Firstly, because I was afraid I would struggle to bond with the baby, And secondly, because I wanted to do a 10-day backpacking trip around Mont Blanc a few weeks after the delivery, which would have been pretty much impossible if I'd had a C-section. So let's just say that I was highly motivated to avoid that recovery from surgery. But that means I spent virtually no time trying to think through what it's like to be a parent. I figured I had 18 years to work on that part. Although I will say that I don't have too many regrets in parenting so far, but one of the few I do have is that I didn't find the idea of respectful parenting until my daughter was about 4 months old. And I now look back on those first few months with a bit of sadness that I wasn't able to begin our relationship in a way that really respected her needs, rather than just assuming that no crying means everything's fine, so do whatever you can to stop the crying. The third of Rossi's four factors is the abruptness of the transition to parenthood. There simply is no internship for parenting, as there would have been in our society in centuries past, or that still exists in other societies today, where young adults see others in their families with young babies and can practice their own skills in advance. And today, more than ever, our lives totally and permanently shift when we have our first child. And I would argue they're irrevocably changed once we have two. My husband and I had a pretty nice life before we had our daughter. We rode bikes on mountains or on the road most weekends during the summer and skied somewhere between 15 and 25 days over the winter. And I hiked a lot and I did yoga classes pretty much whenever I felt like it. And life was busy and pretty fun. In fact, even though it was my husband who wanted children, whenever I would ask him, "Are you ready yet?" he would say, "Let's just get through bike season first." And then at the end of bike season, he'd say, "Let's just do one more ski season first." And so finally I said, "Well, if you keep saying that, there's never going to be a baby." To which he responded, "Well, then I'm ready now." Famous last words, as it turned out. With one child, we're still able to do some of those things. One of us can cover while the other one goes out for a road ride, although we haven't mountain biked in months. I've been able to do a lot of hiking with our daughter on my back, although now we're at the unfortunate age where she's too heavy to carry and also won't walk in a straight line. But if we had two children, as I know many of you do, so I'm probably preaching to the choir, the chances of you being able to engage regularly in things you used to do and find interesting and enjoyable are pretty slim. Fourthly, there's a lack of guidelines to successful parenting, by which Rossi means that it isn't too hard to figure out what are the nutritional and clothing and medical needs and follow the general advice that a child needs loving physical contact and emotional support. But what else is needed to help a child develop into a successful adult? Surely there must be something. Well, it turns out that there are just one or two things, which is a major reason I started this podcast in the first place, to fill that gap between all the books on how to support an infant's growth and development and the changing skill set that a parent needs once the child becomes a toddler and preschooler. This suddenness of transition is the major theme in an even earlier paper by E.E. LeMasters, who found that 38 of 46 couples he interviewed in urban middle-class Wisconsin between 1953 and 1956 reported extensive or severe crisis, the two most severe criteria on a 5-point scale, in adjusting to the arrival of their first child. 89% of these couples rated their marriages as good or better, ratings that were confirmed by close friends in all but three cases, and 35 of the 38 pregnancies in the crisis group were either planned or desired. So it wasn't that the couples were in crisis because of an unplanned pregnancy. The parents didn't have major psychiatric disabilities and were in general of average or above average in what LeMasters called personality adjustment. But all of the couples in the crisis group seemed to have romanticized parenthood and felt ineffectively prepared. As one mother said, "We knew where babies came from, but we didn't know what they were like." The couple's descriptions of early parenthood could have been lifted from any Facebook parenting forum today. The mothers reported loss of sleep, chronic tiredness or exhaustion, confinement to the home and loss of social contacts, giving up the satisfactions and income of a job, having endless laundry to do, feeling guilty about not being a better mother, being on 24/7 and caring for an infant, the decline in their housekeeping standards, although I personally haven't been afflicted by that problem, and worry over their appearance, including increased weight after the pregnancy. The fathers apparently echoed most of these adjustments and added a few of their own. The decline in the wife's sexual responsiveness, which I'll just leave right there without further comment, economic pressure from becoming the only breadwinner at a time when expenses are increasing, worry about a second pregnancy in the near future, and a general disenchantment with the parental role. These are sobering statistics and are among the more dire ones that have been reported. Subsequent studies have confirmed the sudden deteriorations in the relationship between couples after the birth of the couple's first baby, but have found smaller to medium-sized effects rather than the large-scale crisis event that LeMasters reported. As several researchers have noted, and Jennifer Senior comments as well, One is more likely to be happy raising children as part of a couple rather than raising them alone. And also that the level of happiness in marriages tends to decline over time, whether a couple has children or not. But at no point in a marriage does it seem to decline as far and as fast after that first baby is born. And while we can debate the extent of the decline, there is little doubting its pervasiveness. And what causes this erosion in happiness? It seems as though there are two factors. Between the parents themselves, there's one topic that causes more arguments than any other. And if you don't know what it is, then you haven't been living in my household lately. It's the division of work between parents. Men and women work, on average, about the same number of hours each day, but women, on average, still do about twice as much family care, which is defined as housework, childcare, shopping, and chauffeuring, as men. My husband would be quick to add that he commutes for 2.5 hours a day, which is true, a situation that he chose for himself over my objections for precisely the reason that I knew he would walk in the door most nights shortly before bedtime, expecting our daughter to be fed and bathed and his own dinner on the table. And he's not alone. In a study that analyzed a set of video recordings of families in Los Angeles on weekday evenings, mothers were found most often in shared spaces with the children, while fathers were observed most often alone. The least frequently observed configuration was the couple together without the children. And we all know there's a reason why doing the dishes after dinner, that once loathed task, is now seen as the plum assignment over supervising bath time. It's because doing the dishes is far mentally easier than wrangling a 2.5-year-old into the bath. "But I don't want a bath," is followed after shampooing and soaping by. "But I don't want to get out." But most nights I end up doing bath and the dishes anyway, so the choice isn't so bad. And at my house, we see this pattern repeated on the weekends as well. If my daughter and I are in the living room together, then my husband sees himself as relieved and free to read drivel on the internet at his leisure. I will say that he may be better than most husbands at making some effort to protect a small amount of leisure time for me. He will suggest that I go out for a bike ride some weekend mornings, as long as it's not more than an hour and I don't expect things to be any further along at home by the time I get back than when I left. Things like getting either of them dressed, for example. He's quite happy to just enjoy his time with her and leave the chore aspect of childcare to me, unless I set expectations about what I'd like to have done while I'm gone, which I've started to do, even though I wish I didn't have to. So a subset of this first factor causing the erosion of marital happiness is the overscheduled nature of our children's lives these days. Now recall that family care involves chauffeuring the kids around to various activities, often one or more each night of the week, especially when you factor multiple children into the equation. This never-ending series of activities is apparently a uniquely middle-class affliction. It's what middle-class parents do in the short term to try and expose their child to a variety of experiences and, in the long term, to give them the edge they'll need to get into an elite college. And it's exhausting for both the parents and the children. So the second main factor I see in the decline of marital quality is more related to the children, and specifically what it's like to spend time with children, especially young children. Now, I have to say that I've been very lucky to have a relatively easygoing child, although she has just, over the last few weeks, started saying, "No, I don't want to insert activity here." No matter what the inserted activity is and how much she really wants to do it, if I wanted to do it, then it's enough for her to say that she doesn't. And a side effect of being overscheduled when children are young is that they don't know how to tolerate boredom, and they look to us to alleviate it when it occurs. While our parents were cooking and cleaning and hanging out with the neighbors and running a network of nonprofit organizations, they would typically tell us to just go and clean our rooms if we were bored. But we're more likely to ship our own children off to a gymnastics class. Now, I want to digress here for a moment to discuss the concept of flow. Now, please trust me that it will all come back together in a couple of minutes. This term was coined by the psychologist, whose name I'm going to hope not to butcher, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, although the idea has existed in other forms, most notably in some Eastern religions for thousands of years. When you've achieved flow, you're in the zone. The original six characteristics of flow are, 1, intense and focused concentration on the present moment, 2, merging of action and awareness, 3, a loss of reflective self-consciousness so you're not easily distracted, 4, a sense of personal control or agency over the situation or activity, 5, a distortion of temporal experience. Some people say time seems to slow down, while others say it seems to speed up. And 6, an experience of the activity as intrinsically rewarding. These aspects can appear independently of each other, but it's only when they occur together that a person is experiencing flow. Csikszentmihalyi later added a criterion that the activity must have a clear set of goals and process markers, which add direction and structure to the task. Another researcher, Kendra Cherry, adds 3 more components of the flow experience. Firstly, immediate feedback on what you're doing. Secondly, feeling that you have the potential to succeed. And thirdly, feeling so engrossed in the experience that other needs, like hunger perhaps, become negligible. Finally, one more researcher, Owen Schaefer, adds an element that I find particularly important, the idea of having a high degree of perceived challenge and the skills and abilities to meet those challenges. Perhaps you can already think of an activity that you do, or used to do, where you get into flow. I always think of a friend of mine who likes to surf, and when I asked him why, he said, because I'm 100% focused on that wave. He gets immediate feedback from the board about how well he's doing, and he has the skills to be able to adjust his performance to meet the degree of challenge that the waves offer. Flow states are actually pretty common in sporting activities, where a person really enjoys the activity and is skilled at it, and is able to get into a flow state, perhaps during competitions, so that while the performance is extrinsically rewarded by a prize, it's the intrinsic reward of having surfed well or vaulted well that represents the real reward. It's also not uncommon at work, if you've been lucky enough to set up a work environment that you enjoy and are good at, as well as in video gaming, because game designers specifically design games to maximize flow, and also in music. And very often, these characteristics make flow a solo pursuit, something that happens in your own head, rather than something that is shared with others. Now imagine the last afternoon that you spent with your toddler or preschooler. How much of it would you say was spent in a flow state? Probably not very much, and you're not alone. Jennifer Sr. actually tracked down Csikszentmihalyi at a conference a few years ago and asked why he didn't devote more research to flow in family situations. He actually said that he first experimented on himself when he created a new kind of sampling method, which is called experience sampling, where a person is given a pager that is paged randomly throughout the day. When it beeps, the person is supposed to write down what they're doing as well as how they feel about what they're doing, which is really the first time anyone had tried to gauge how study participants felt in the moment, rather than asking them about it afterwards. So he invents this method and he tries it out on himself. And at the end of the week, he realizes that when he's with his sons, his moods are usually pretty negative. And he wasn't even dealing with toddlers, his kids were older by then. He said he thought to himself, this doesn't make any sense to me because I'm very proud of them and we have a good relationship. But what he realized was that the activities he was doing were about as unflow-like as you can get. Nagging them to get up so they wouldn't be late for school or to put away their cereal dish from breakfast. And nagging, as it turns out, is not a flow activity. But he observed that when family life is relaxed, we tend to find it boring. And when it's not relaxed, we're dealing with a tantrum which overloads us. And instead of clearly understanding the rules of the game so we can minutely adjust our performance, our toddlers and preschoolers keep changing the rules of engagement, which makes it even harder for us to optimize our performance. Bath time wasn't such a huge fight in our household a month ago, and perhaps it won't be again in another month, but who knows? This is why the little moments can seem so gosh darn irritating, because she's dawdling down the hallway having just taken off her shoes again when we needed to get out of the house 10 minutes ago. But when we look back on the whole experience of parenting, we're inclined to see it as a joyful thing. It's the difference between the way we think about things as we experience them and how we remember them afterwards. And in psychology circles, it's called the rosy view. It's actually been documented that people recall having a far better time on holiday than was the actual experience. I suppose if we didn't have this overall image of parenting being a positive thing, we'd just stop having children, which wouldn't be much good for the species. So what are we supposed to do about this? Well, the experiment that I've been trying at home, with some success, is to create more flow-like states in everyday activities with my daughter, which is especially interesting to me because it's very time efficient. It allows me to get chores done that need doing while attending to her needs to develop as a person and my needs to spend more of my time in a flow-like state rather than being stressed out about all the things I need to do. Those of you who listened to our episode on chores a couple of weeks ago know that I've been making an effort to engage my daughter in everyday activities around the house because it not only gets work done, but it actually aids in her own cognitive and social development. If you missed that episode, you really should go back and check it out because there's a lot more information on how the social aspect of working together helps to engage children in doing work that they might otherwise be uninterested in doing. So let's take cooking dinner, for example. It's actually something my daughter enjoys helping, quote unquote, with, but it's still a chore that needs to get done every night. What I realized is if I just shift my perspective a little bit from we need to get dinner on the table right now to let's just enjoy this moment together as we cook dinner, I can get into more of a flow-like state. I need to concentrate intensely because my daughter really does want to help, and managing that plus moving the recipe along and making sure nothing gets burned requires a lot of concentration on my part, to the extent that I'm not easily distracted while we're doing it. I have a sense of agency in that I'm a decent, although not amazing, cook myself, so I know the techniques I need to use, and providing activities that are sufficiently challenging to my daughter while not being so challenging she can't do them challenges me as well. I do find the experience intrinsically rewarding. I enjoy cooking, and I enjoy the healthy meal that we get out of it at the end. And I also enjoy the fact that I know the activities are making a positive contribution to her development. There's a clear goal at the end, which is dinner, and steps that must be followed, the recipe, and immediate feedback as my daughter finishes the task that she takes on, or gets stuck, or drops an egg on the floor. The most critical element to me is my immersion in the task in the moment. Much as toddlers do all the time, I'm not thinking about all the things I need to get done later in the evening, because I know roughly how long the recipe takes to prepare, and that we will have enough time for everything else that needs to get done later, so I can put them out of my mind right now and just concentrate on having this experience with my daughter. For this reason, I deliberately pick easy or moderately difficult dishes to cook on weeknights and save the more complicated recipes, or just the recipes I'm trying for the first time, for the weekends when I have backup coverage, if it can be distracted away from the drivel on the internet. Honestly, I'd say it's working pretty well for us at the moment. It's way less stressful for me to have to find other time during the day to do dinner preparation so I can set up some artificial learning activity for her when we get home from daycare. It's certainly not perfect, which is why I use the term flow-like state rather than just flow. On any given day, one or two of the required elements might be missing. But you know what? I'll take a flow-like state over a stressed-out dinner preparation any night of the week. There's also great potential for a flow-like state while I'm grocery shopping with her. Instead of just rushing through the store as fast as we can, like we have to do on some days, we can take the time to talk about the things we see in the store, or pick out new fruits to try, and weigh several items on the scales and guess which of two items will be heavier. And as a side note, this activity has led her to ask, "How much pounds?" when she wants to know how much of any item we need or are using, including those that are commonly measured by volume, like oats and bathwater. So my challenge to you is to pick a chore that you need to do on a regular basis, preferably one that your child has already expressed an interest in helping you out with, and reorienting your mind around it so you can get into a more flow-like state while you're doing it to increase your enjoyment of your time with your children, as well as just your own life in general. Because really, isn't life too short for all joy and no fun? And what about those pesky chore divisions, and also the fact that we tend to overthink every decision about our kids? Well, Jennifer Senior recommends that if you don't have a French mother hanging around to tell you to relax your housekeeping standards, or worry less about your kids, or take more time for yourself, then you should consider looking to your husband as an example, because chances are he has a thing or two to teach you about each of those things. Thanks for listening. If you're interested in the references for today's episode, you can find them at yourparentingmojo.com/joy, and you can also subscribe to the podcast at yourparentingmojo.com.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Your Parenting Mojo. Please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes, and sign up for our mailing list at yourparentingmojo.com to receive a free gift. 7 relationship-based strategies to support your children's development while making parenting just a little bit easier on you. For more respectful, research-based parenting ideas to help kids thrive, we'll see you next time on Your Parenting Mojo.